Side 2. Death is a Lonely Business, continuing on page 48. From this green place came the smell of oranges and apricots in season, and what wasn't orange or apricot was cactus or epiphyllum or night-blooming jasmine. No lawnmower ever sounded here, no scythe ever whispered, no fog ever came. On the boundary of Venice's damp eternal twilight, the bungalow survived amid lemons that glowed like Christmas tree lights all winter long. And on occasion, walking by, you thought you heard Okapi rushing and thumping a Serengeti plain in there, or great sunset clouds of flamingos startled up and wheeling in pure fire. And in that place, wise about the weather and dedicated to the preservation of his eternally sunburned soul, lived a man some 44 years old with a balding head and a raspy voice, whose business, when he moved toward the sea and breathed the fog, was bruised customs, broken laws, and the occasional death that could be murder. Elmo Crumley. And I found him and his house, because a series of people had listened to my queries, nodded, and pointed directions. Everyone agreed that every late afternoon the short detective ambled into that green jungle territory and disappeared, amid the sounds of hippos rising and flamingos in descent. What should I do? I thought. Stand on the edge of his wild country and shout his name? But Crumley shouted first. Jesus Christ, is that you? He was coming out of his jungle compound and trekking along the weed path just as I arrived at his front gate. It's me. As the detective trail blazed his own uncut path, I thought I heard the sounds I had always imagined as I passed. Thompson's gazelles on the leap, crossword puzzle zebras panicked just beyond me, plus a smell of golden pea on the wind. Lions. Seems to me, groused Crumley, we played this scene yesterday. You come to apologize? You've got stuff to say that's louder and funnier? If you'd stop moving and listen, I said. Your voice carries, I'll say that. Lady I know, 3 blocks from where you found the body, said because of your yell that night, her cats still haven't come home. Okay, I'm standing here. And? With every one of his words, my fists had jammed deeper into my sports jacket pockets. Somehow I couldn't pull them out. Head ducked, eyes averted, I tried to get my breath. Crumley glanced at his wristwatch. There was a man behind me on the train that night, I cried suddenly. He was the one stuffed the old gentleman in the lion cage. Keep your voice down, how do you know? My fists worked in my pockets, squeezing. I could feel his hands stretched out behind me. I could feel his fingers working, pleading. He wanted me to turn and see him. Don't all killers want to be found out? That's what dime store psychologists say. Why didn't you look at him? You don't make eye contact with drunks. They come sit and breathe on you. Right. Crumley allowed himself a touch of curiosity. He took out a tobacco pouch and paper and started rolling a cigarette, deliberately not looking at me. And? You should have heard his voice. You'd believe if you'd heard. My God, it was like Hamlet's father's ghost from the bottom of the grave, crying out, remember me, but more than that, see me, know me, arrest me. Crumley lit his cigarette and peered at me through the smoke. His voice aged me 10 years in a few seconds, I said. I've never been so sure of my feelings in my life. Everybody in the world has feelings. Crumley examined his cigarette as if he couldn't decide whether he liked it or not. Everyone's grandma writes Wheaties jingles and hums them until you want to kick the barley malt out of the old crone. Songwriters, poets, amateur detectives, every damn fool thinks he's all three. You know what you remind me of, son? That mob of idiots that swarmed after Alexander Pope, waving their poems, novels, and essays asking for advice, until Pope ran mad and wrote his Essay on Criticism. You know Alexander Pope? Crumley gave an aggrieved sigh, tossed down his cigarette, stepped on it. You think all detectives are gumshoes with glue between their ears? Yeah, Pope, for Christ's sake. I read him under the sheets late night so my folks wouldn't think I was queer. Now get out of the way. You mean all this is for nothing? I cried. You're not going to try to save the old man? I blushed, hearing what I had said. I know what you meant, said Crumley, patiently. He looked off along the street, as if he could see all the way to my apartment, and the desk, and the typewriter standing there. You've latched onto a good thing, or you think you have. So you run fevers, You want to get on that big red streetcar and ride back some night and catch that drunk and haul him in. But if you do, he won't be there. Or if he is, not the same guy, or you won't know him. So right now you've got bloody fingernails from beating your typewriter, and the stuff's coming good, as Hemingway says, and your intuition is growing long antennae that are ever so sensitive. That and pig's knuckles buys me no sauerkraut. He started off around the front of his car in a replay of yesterday's disaster. Oh, no, you don't, I yelled. Not again. You know what you are? Jealous. Crumley's head almost came off his shoulders. He whirled. I'm what? I almost saw his fingers reach for a gun that wasn't there. And, I floundered. You're never going to make it! My insolence staggered him. His head swiveled to stare at me over the top of his car. Make what? He said. Whatever it is you want to do, you won't do it. I jolted to a full stop, astounded. I couldn't remember ever having yelled like this at anyone. In school, I had been the prize custard. Every time some teacher slammed her jaws, my crust fell. But now, unless you learn, I said lamely, feeling my face fill up with hot color, to listen to your stomach and not your head. Norman Rockwell's philosophical advice for wayward sleuths. Crumley leaned against his car as if it were the only thing in the world that held him up. A laugh burst from his mouth, which he capped with his palm, and he said, muffled, Continue. You don't want to hear. Kid, I haven't had a laugh in days. My mouth gummed itself shut. I closed my eyes. Go on, said Crumley with a gentler tone. It's just, I said slowly, I learned years ago that the harder I thought, the worse my work got. Everyone thinks you have to go around thinking all the time. No, I go around feeling, and put it down, and feel again, and write that down, and at the end of the day, think about it. Thinking comes later. There was a curious light in Crumley's face. He tilted his head, now this way to look at me, and then tilted it the other way, like a monkey in the zoo staring out through the bars and wondering what the hell that beast is there outside. Then, without a word, or another laugh or smile, he simply slid into the front seat of his car, calmly turned on the ignition, softly pressed the gas, and slowly, slowly drove away. About 20 yards down the line, he braked the car, thought for a moment, backed up, and leaned over to look at me and yelled, Jesus H. Christ! Proof! God damn it, proof! Which made me yank my right hand out of my jacket pocket so fast it almost tore the cloth. I held my fist out at last and opened my trembling fingers. There, I said. You know what that is? No. Do I know what it is? Yes. Do I know who the old man is? Yes. Do you know his name? No. Crumley put his head down on his crossed arms on the steering wheel. He sighed. Okay, let's have it. These, I said, staring at the junk in my palm, are little A's and small B's and tiny C's. Alphabets, letters, punched out of trolley paper transfers. Because you drive a car, you haven't seen any of this stuff for years. Because all I do since I got off my roller skates is walk or take trains, I'm up to my armpits in these punch-outs. Crumley lifted his head slowly, not wanting to seem curious or eager. I said, This one old man down at the trolley station was always cramming his pockets with these. He'd throw this confetti on folks on New Year's Eve, or sometimes in July, and yell, Happy Fourth! When I saw you turn that poor old guy's pockets inside out, I knew it had to be him. Now what do you say? There was a long silence. Shit. Crumley seemed to be praying to himself, his eyes shut, as mine had been only a minute ago. God help me. Get in.
What?
Get in, goddammit. You're going to prove what you just said. You think I'm an idiot?
Yes. I mean, no.
I yanked the door open, struggling with my left fist in my left pocket. I got this other stuff, seaweed, left by my door last night, and shut up and handle the map. The car leaped forward. I jumped in just in time to enjoy whiplash. Elmo Crumley and I stepped into the tobacco smells of an eternally attic day. Crumley stared at the empty space between the old men who leaned like dry wicker chairs against each other. Crumley moved forward to hold out his hand and show them the dry-caked alphabet confetti. The old men had had 2 days now to think about the empty seat between them.
"Son of a bitch," one of them whispered.
"If a cop," murmured one of them, blinking at the mulch in his palm, "shows me something like that, it's got to come from Willie's pockets. You want me to come identify him?"
The other two old men leaned away from this one who spoke, as if he had said something unclean. Crumley nodded. The old man shoved his cane under his trembling hands and hoisted himself up. Crumley tried to help, but the fiery look the old man shot him moved him away.
"Stand aside!"
The old man battered the hardwood floor with his cane, as if punishing it for the bad news, and was out the door. We followed him out into that mist and fog and rain where God's light had just failed in Venice, Southern California. We walked into the morgue with a man 82 years old, but when we came out he was 110 and could no longer use his cane. The fire was gone from his eyes, so he didn't even beat us off as we tried to help him out to the car, and he was mourning over and over,
"My God, who gave him that awful haircut? When did that happen?"
He babbled because he needed to talk nonsense.
"Did you do that to him?"
he cried to no one.
"Who did that? Who?"
I know, I thought, but didn't tell. As we got him out of the car and back to sit in his own place on that cold bench where the other men waited, pretending not to notice our return, their eyes on the ceiling or the floor, waiting until we were gone so they could decide whether to stay away from the stranger their old friend had become, or move closer to keep him warm. Crumley and I were very quiet as we drove back to the as-good-as-empty Canaries for Sale house. I stood outside the door while Crumley went in to look at the blank wall of the old man's room and look at the names, the names, the names. William, Willie, Will, Bill, Smith, 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 fingernails scratched there in the plaster, making himself immortal. When he came out, Crumley stood blinking back into the terribly empty room.
"Christ," he murmured. "Did you read the words on the wall?"
"All of them." Crumley looked around and was dismayed to find himself outside the door, staring in.
"He's standing in the hall."
"Who stood here?" Crumley turned to measure me.
"Was it you?"
"You know it wasn't," I said, edging back.
"I could arrest you for breaking and entering, I suppose."
"And you won't do that," I said nervously. "The door, all the doors, have been open for years. Anyone could come in."
"Someone did."
Crumley glanced back into the silent room.
"How do I know you didn't scratch those words on that wall with your own damned fingernail just to get my hair up and make me believe your cockamamie theory?"
The writing on the wall was wobbly, an old man's scribble.
"You could have thought of that and imitated an old man's scrawl."
"Could have done, but didn't do. My God, what do you need to convince you?"
"More than goose flesh on my neck, I'll tell you that."
"Then," I said, my hands back in my pockets again, making fists, the seaweed still hidden but waiting, "the rest is upstairs. Go up. Look. Come down. Tell me what you see." Crumley tilted his head to give me one of those monkey looks, then sighed and went up like an old shoe salesman carrying an anvil in each hand. At the top of the stairs, he stood like Lord Carnarvon outside Tutankhamun's waiting tomb for a long moment. Then he went in. I thought I heard the ghosts of old birds rustling and peering. I thought I heard a mummy whisper, rising from river dusts. But that was the old muse in me, anxious for startlements. What I heard was Crumley pacing the milkweed silt on the old woman's floor, which muffled his tread. A birdcage gave a metallic bell sound. He had touched it. Then what I heard was him bending over to lend an ear to a wind of time that moved from a dry and aching mouth. And what I heard finally was the sound of the name on the wall whispered once, twice, three times, as if the old canary woman were reading the Egyptian hieroglyphs, symbol by symbol. When Crumley came back down, he was carrying the anvils in his stomach, and his face was tired.
I'm getting out of this business, he said. I waited. Hirohito ascends throne. He quoted the old newsprint he had just seen at the bottom of the cage. Addis Ababa, I said. Was it really that long ago? Now you've seen it all, I said. What's your conclusion? What conclusion should I have? Didn't you read it in her face? Didn't you see? What? She's next. What? It's all there, in her eyes. She knows about the man who stands in the hall. He's been up to her room also, but hasn't gone in. She's simply waiting and praying for him. I'm cold all over and can't get warm. Just because you were right about the trolley ticket punch-out junk and found his place and ID'd the man doesn't make you tarot card champ of the week. You're cold all over? I'm cold all over. Your hunch and my chill buys no dog food for a dead dog. If you don't post a guard here, she'll be dead in 2 days. If we posted guards over everybody who's going to be dead in 2 days, we'd have no more police. You want me to go tell the captain what to do with his men? He'd throw me downstairs and throw my badge after me. Look, she's nobody. I hate to say that, but that's the way the law runs. If she were somebody, maybe we'd post. I'll do it myself, then. Think what you just said. You gotta eat sometime, or sleep. You can't be here, and you know it. The first time you run for a hot dog is when he, him, who, whomever, if he exists, will come in, make her sneeze, and she's gone. There was never any man here. It was only an old hairball blowing by in the night. The old guy heard it first. Mrs. Canary hears it now. Crumley stared up the long dark stairs toward the place of no bird song, no springtime in the Rockies, no bad organist playing for his tiny yellow friends in some lost year. Give me time to think, kid, he said. And let you be an accessory to murder? There you go again. Crumley yanked the door so it screamed on its hinges. How come I spend half my time almost liking you, and the rest being mad as hell? Do I do that to you? I said. But he was gone. Crumley did not call for 24 hours. Grinding my teeth into a fine powder, I primed my Underwood and steamrolled Crumley into the platen. Speak, I typed. How come, Crumley responded, typing from somewhere inside my amazing machine, I spend half my time almost liking you and the rest being mad as hell? Then the machine typed, I'll telephone you on the day the old canary lady dies. It's obvious that years back I had pasted 2 gummed labels on my Underwood. One read, Official Ouija Board. The other, in large letters, Don't Think. I didn't. I just let the old Ouija board bang and clatter. How soon do we work together on this problem? You, responded Crumley in my fingertips, are the problem. Will you become a character in my novel? I already am. Then help me. Fat chance. Damn. I tore the page out of the machine. Just then, my private phone rang. It seemed it took me 10 miles of running to get there, thinking, Peg. All the women in my life have been librarians, teachers, writers, or booksellers. Peg was at least 3 of those, but she was far away now, and it terrified me. She had been all summer in Mexico, finishing studies in Spanish literature, learning the language, traveling on trains with mean peons, or buses with happy pigs, writing me love-scorched letters from Tamasunchare, or bored ones from Acapulco, where the sun was too bright and the gigolos not bright enough. Not for her, anyway, friend to Henry James and consultant to Voltaire and Benjamin Franklin. She carried a lunch bucket full of books everywhere. I often thought she ate the brothers Goncourt like high tea sandwiches in the late afternoon. Peg. Once a week she called from somewhere lost in the church towns or big cities, just come up out of the mummy catacombs at Guanajuato, or gasping after a climb down Teotihuacan, and we listened to each other's heartbeats for 3 short minutes, and said the same dumb things to each other over and over and over, the sort of litany that sounds fine no matter how long or often you say it. Each week when the call came, the sun blazed over the phone booth. Each week when the talk stopped, the sun died and the fog arose. I wanted to run, pull the covers over my head.
Instead, I punched my typewriter into bad poems, or wrote a tale about a Martian wife who, lovesick, dreams that an Earthman drops from the sky to take her away and gets shot for his trouble. Peg. Some weeks, as poor as I was, we pulled the old telephone tricks. The operator calling from Mexico City would ask for me by name. Who? I would say. What was that again? Operator, speak up. I would hear Peg sigh far away. The more I talked nonsense, the longer I was on the line. Just a moment, operator, let me get that again. The operator repeated my name. Wait, let me see if he's here. Who's calling? And Peg's voice swiftly would respond from 2,000 miles off. Tell him it's Peg. Peg. And I would pretend to go away and return. He's not here. Call back in an hour. An hour, echoed Peg. And click, buzz, hum, she was gone. Peg. I leaped into the booth and yanked the phone off the hook. Yes, I yelled. But it wasn't Peg. Silence. Who is this? I said. Silence. But someone was there, not 2,000 miles away, but very near, and the reception was so clear I could hear the air move in the nostrils and mouth of the quiet one at the other end. Well, I said. Silence. And the sound that waiting makes on a telephone line. Whoever it was had his mouth open close to the receiver. Whisper. Whisper. Jesus God, I thought, this can't be a heavy breather calling me in a phone booth. People don't call phone booths. No one knows this is my private office. Silence. Breath. Silence. Breath. I swear that cool air whispered from the receiver and froze my ear. No thanks, I said, and hung up. I was halfway across the street, jogging with my eyes shut, when I heard the phone ring again. I stood in the middle of the street, staring back at the phone, afraid to go touch it, afraid of the breathing. But the longer I stood there, in danger of being run down, the more the phone sounded like a funeral phone, calling from a burial ground, with bad telegram news. I had to go pick up the receiver. "She's still alive," said a voice. "Peg!" I yelled. "Take it easy," said Elmo Crumley. I fell against the side of the booth, fighting for breath, relieved, but angry. "Did you call a moment ago?" I gasped. "How do you know this number?" "Everyone in the whole goddamn town's heard that phone ring and seen you jumping for it." "Who's alive?" "The canary lady. Checked her late last night." "That was last night." "That's not why I'm calling, damn it. Get over to my place late this afternoon. I might just rip your skin off." "Why?" 3 o'clock in the morning, what were you doing standing outside my house?"
"Me."
"You'd better have a good alibi, by God. I don't like being spooked. I'll be home around 5. If you talk fast, you get maybe a beer. If you bat an eye, I kick ass."
"Crumley,"
I yelled.
"Be there."
And he hung up. I walked slowly back toward my front door. The phone rang again.
"Peg."
Or the man with cold ice in his breath. Or Crumley being mean. I banged the door open, jumped in, slammed it, and then with excruciating patience rolled a fresh white sheet of Elmo Crumley into my Underwood and forced him to say only nice things to me. 10,000 tons of fog poured over Venice and touched at my windows and came in under the cracks in the door. Every time it is a damp, drear November in my soul, I know it is high time to go from the sea again and let someone cut my hair. There is a thing in haircutting that assuages the blood and calms the heart and makes the nerves serene. Beyond that, I heard the old man stumbling out of the morgue in the back of my mind, wailing, "My God, who gave him that awful haircut?" Cal, of course, had done that awful job, so I had several reasons to go visit. Cal, the worst barber in Venice, maybe the world, but cheap, called across the tidal waves of fog, waiting with his dull scissors, brandishing his bumblebee electric clippers that shocked and stunned poor writers and innocent customers who wandered in. Cal, I thought, snip away the darkness, short in front so I can see, short on the sides so I can hear, short in back so I can feel things creeping up on me, short. But I didn't make it to Cal's just then. As I stepped out of my apartment into the fog, a parade of great dark elephants went by on Windward Avenue, which is to say a pavan of black trunks with huge cranes and immense pile pullers on the back. They were in full thunder and heading for the pier to knock it down or begin to knock it down. The rumors had been afloat for months, and now the day was here, or tomorrow morning at the latest. I had more of the day to wait to go see Crumley. And Cal was not exactly the greatest lure in the world. The elephants lumbered and groaned their machineries and shook the pavement on their way to devour the funhouse and the horses on the carousel. Feeling like an old Russian writer madly in love with killing winter and blizzards on the move, what could I do but follow? By the time I got to the pier, half the trucks had lumbered down on the sand to move out toward the tides and catch the junk that would be tossed over the railings. The others had headed out toward China on the rotting planks, sawdusting the wooden mulch on the way. I followed, sneezing and using Kleenex. I should be home, lying with my cold, but the thought of going to bed with so many fog and mist and rain thoughts slogged me on. I stood amazed at my own blindness, halfway down the length of the pier, wondering at all the people here I had seen but never known. Half of the games were nailed shut with fresh-cut pine planks. A few stayed open, waiting for the bad weather to come in and toss hoops or knock milk bottles down. Outside half a dozen stalls, the young men who looked old, or the old men who looked older, stood watching those trucks growling out on the sea end of the pier, getting ready to tooth and nail 60 years of past time. I looked around, realizing I had rarely seen behind the dropped flat doors or the rolled down and battened canvases. I had the feeling again of being followed and spun about. A big plume of fog came along the pier, ignored me, and passed on. So much for premonition. Here, halfway to the sea, there was a small dark shack that I had passed for at least 10 years without seeing the window shades up. Today, for the first time, the shades were raised. I looked in. My God, I thought, there's a whole library there. I walked swiftly over, wondering how many similar libraries were hidden away on the pier or lost in the old alleys of Venice. I stood by the window, remembering nights when I had seen a light behind the shade and a shadow hand turning pages in an invisible book, and heard a voice whispering the words, declaiming poetries, philosophizing on a dark universe. It had always sounded like a writer with second thoughts, or an actor slipping downhill into a ghost repertory, Lear with two extra sets of mean daughters and only half the wits. But now at noon this day the shades were up. Inside, a small light still burned in a room empty of occupants, but filled with a desk, a chair, and an old-fashioned but huge leather couch. Around the couch, on all sides, towering to the ceiling, were cliffs and towers and parapets of books. There must have been 1,000 of them, crammed and shoved up to the ceiling. I stepped back and looked at the signs I had seen but not seen around and above the shack door. Tarot cards. But the print was faded. The next sign down read Palmistry. The third one in block letters was Phrenology, and beneath, Handwriting Analysis, and to one side, Hypnotism. I sidled closer to the door, for there was a very small business card thumb-tacked just above the doorknob. I read the name of the shack's owner, A.L. Schrank, and underneath the name, in pencil not quite so faint as Canaries for Sale, these words, Practicing psychologist. A sextuple threat man. I put my ear to the door and listened. In there, between precipice shelves of dusty books, did I hear Sigmund Freud whispering, "A penis is only a penis, but a good cigar is a smoke"? Hamlet dying and taking everyone along? Virginia Woolf, like drowned Ophelia, stretching out to dry on that couch, telling her sad tale? Tarot cards being shuffled? Heads being felt like cantaloupes, pen scratching. "Let's peek," I said. Again I stared through the window, but all I saw was the empty couch with the outline of many bodies in its middle. It was the only bed. Nights A.L. Schrank slept there. Days did strangers lie there, holding on to their insides as if they were broken glass. I could not believe. But the books were the things that fascinated me. They not only brimmed the shelves, but filled the bathtub, which I could glimpse through a half-open door to one side. There was no kitchen. If there had been, the icebox would have been filled, no doubt, with copies of Perry at the North Pole, or Bird Alone in Antarctica. A.L. Schrank, it was obvious, bathed in the sea, like many others here, and had his banquets at Herman's Hot Dogs down the way. But it was not so much the presence of 900 or 1,000 books, as it was their titles, their subjects, their incredible dark and doomed and awful names. On the high, always midnight shelves stood Thomas Hardy in all his gloom, next to The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which leaned on dread Nietzsche and hopeless Schopenhauer, cheek by jowl with The Anatomy of Melancholy, Edgar Allan Poe, Mary Shelley, Freud, The Tragedies of Shakespeare, no comedies visible, the Marquis de Sade, Thomas de Quincey, Hitler's Mein Kampf, Spengler's Decline of the West, and on and on. Eugene O'Neill was there. Oscar Wilde, but only his sad prison essay, none of his lilac fluff or gentian laughs. Genghis Khan and Mussolini leaned on each other. Books with titles like Suicide is an Answer, or The Dark Knight of Hamlet, or Lemmings to the Sea, were on the high shelf in snows. On the floor lay World War II and Krakatoa, the explosion heard round the world, along with India the Hungry and The Red Sun Rises. If you run your eye and mind along books like that, and run your stare along again disbelieving, there is only one thing you can do, like a bad film version of Morning Becomes Electra, where one suicide follows another, and murder tops murder, and incest incites incest, and blackmail supersedes poisoned apples, and people fall down stairs or step on strychnine tacks. You finally snort, toss back your head, and laugh. "What's so funny?" said someone behind me. I turned. I said, "What's so funny?" He stood with his thin, pale face about 6 inches from the tip of my nose. The man who slept on that analysis couch. The man who owned all those end-of-the-world books. A.L. Schrank. "Well?" he said. "Your library," I stammered. A.L. Schrank glared, waiting. Luckily, I sneezed, which erased my laugh and let me cover my confusion with a Kleenex. "Forgive me. Forgive," I said. "I own exactly 14 books. It's not often you see the New York Public Library imported to Venice Pier." The flames went out in A.L. Schrank's tiny, bright yellow fox eyes. His wire-thin shoulders sank. His tiny fists opened up. My praise caused him to glance through his own window like a stranger and gape. "Why," he murmured, amazed, "yes, they're all mine." I stood looking down at a man no taller than 5'1 or 5'2, maybe less without his shoes. I had a terrible urge to check to see if he wore 3-inch heels, but kept my eyes level with the top of his head. He was not even aware of my inspection, so proud was he of the proliferation of literary beasts that infested his dark shelves. "I have 5,910 books," he announced. "You sure it's not 5,911? He very carefully looked only in at his library and said in a cold voice, "Why are you laughing?" "The titles." "The titles?" He leaned closer to the window to search the shelves for some bright traitor among all those assassin books. "Well," I said lamely, "aren't there any summers, good weather, fair winds in your library? Don't you own any glad books? Happy finds like Leacock's Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town, The Sun is My Undoing, In the Good Old Summertime, June Laughter?"
"No."
Schrank stood on tiptoe to say this, then caught himself and sank down. "No." "How about Peacock's Headlong Hall, or Huck Finn, Three Men in a Boat, How Green Was My Father, Pickwick Papers, Robert Benchley, James Thurber, S.J. Perlman?" I machine-gunned the titles. Schrank listened and almost cringed back at my recitation of joy. He let me run down. "How about the Savonarola Joke Book, or The Funny Sayings of Jack the Ripper?" I stopped. A.L. Schrank was all shadow and ice, turning away. "Sorry," I said, and I was. "What I'd really like to do someday is come by to browse. That is, if you'll let me." A.L. Schrank weighed this, decided I was repentant, and moved to touch his shop-front door. It whined softly open. He turned to examine me with his tiny, bright amber eyes, his thin fingers twitching at his sides.
"Why not now?" he said.
"I can't. Later, Mr. Shrank, A.L. Shrank, consulting psychologist. No, not Shrink, as you might be thinking, as in psychiatrist, just plain Shrank, meadow doctor to lost creatures."
He was imitating my banter. His thin smile was a weak tea duplicate of my own. I felt it would vanish if I in turn shut my mouth. I glanced above him.
"How come you've left that old tarot card sign in place? And what about phrenology and hypnotism?"
"You forgot to mention my handwriting analysis sign. And the one mentioning numerology is just inside the door. Be my guest."
I moved, but stopped.
"Come along," said A.L. Shrank.
"Come on," he said, really smiling now. The smile of a fish, however, not of a dog.
"Step in."
At each gentle command, I inched forward, my eyes touching with all too obvious irony on the hypnotism sign above the tiny man's head. His eyes did not blink.
"Come," said A.L. Shrank, nodding at his library without looking at it.
I found the invitation irresistible in spite of the car crashes, dirigible burnings, mine explosions, and mental dilapidations I knew each book contained.
"Well," I said, at which moment the entire pier shook. Far out at the end in the fog a great creature had struck the pier. It was like a whale bunting a ship, or the Queen Mary plowing into the ancient pilings. The big iron brutes out there, hidden, were beginning to tear the planks apart. The vibrations knocked the planks and came up through my body and Shrank's body with jolts of mortality and doom. Our bones shook in our blood. We both jerked our heads to try to stare through the fog at the devastation somewhere beyond. The mighty blows jarred me a modicum away from the door. The titanic buffeting trembled and shivered and inched A.L. Shrank on his sill like a lost toy. A paleness bloomed within the paleness of his face. He looked like a man panicked by an earthquake or a tidal wave rushing at the pier. Again and again the great machines hammered and pounded in the fog 100 yards away, and invisible cracks seemed to appear in A.L. Shrank's milk-glass brow and cheeks. The war had begun. Soon the dark tanks would lumber along the pier, destroying as they came, a flood of carnival emigres running before them toward land. A.L. Shrank soon to be among them, as his house of dark tarot cards fell. It was my chance to escape, but I failed. Shrank's gaze had returned to me, as if I could save him from that invasion just beyond. In a moment he might seize my elbow for support. The pier shook. I shut my eyes. I thought I heard my secret office telephone ring. I almost cried out, "My phone, it's for me!" But I was saved from that by a tide of men and women and a few children hurrying the other way, not toward land, but rushing toward the sea end of the pier, a large man in a dark cloak and a floppy G.K. Chesterton hat leading the way.
"Last ride, last day, last time," he yelled, "last chance. Come on!"
"Shapeshade," whispered A.L. Shrank.
And that's who it was. Shapeshade, the sole owner and proprietor of the old Venice Cinema at the foot of the pier, which would be ground underfoot and turned to celluloid mulch within the week.
"This way!"
called Shapeshade's voice from the mist. I glanced at A.L. Shrank. He shrugged and nodded, giving permission. I ran off into the fog. The long chattering clack and grind, the ascending slow clang, rattle and roar, like some robot centipede of immense size scaling the side of a nightmare, pausing at the top for the merest breath, then cascading in a serpentine of squeal, rush, and thunderous roar, in scream, in human shriek down the abysmal span, there to attack more swiftly this time another hill, another ascending scale rising yet higher and higher to fall off into hysteria. The roller coaster. I stood looking up at it through the mist. In an hour, so they said, it would be dead. It had been part of my life as long as I could remember. From here most nights you could hear people laughing and screaming as they soared up to the heights of so-called existence and plunged down toward an imaginary doom. So this was to be a final ride, late in the afternoon, just before the dynamite experts taped explosives to the dinosaur's legs and brought him to his knees.
"Jump in," a boy yelled. "It's free."
Even free, I never thought it was anything but torture, I said.
Hey, look who's here in the front seat, someone called. And behind.
Mr. Shapeshade was there, cramming his vast black hat down over his ears, laughing. Back of him was Annie Oakley, the rifle lady. Back of her sat the man who had run the fun house. Alongside him was the old lady who spun the pink cotton candy machine and sold illusion that melted in your mouth and left you hungry long before Chinese food. Back of them were the knock-a-milk bottle and the toss-a-hoop team, everyone looking like they were posing for a passport photo to eternity. Only Mr. Shapeshade, as coxswain, was jubilant. As Captain Ahab said, "Don't be yellow," he called. That made me feel like a sheep. I let the roller coaster ticket terror help me into the coward's back row. "This your first trip?" he laughed. "And my last." "Everyone set to scream?" "Why not?" cried Shapeshade. "Let me out," I thought. "We'll all die." "Here goes," the ticket man yelled. "Nothing." It was heaven going up and hell all the way down. I had this terrible feeling they blew the legs out from under the roller coaster as we descended. When we hit bottom, I glanced over. A.L. Schrank stood on the pier, staring up at us lunatics who had willingly boarded the Titanic. A.L. Schrank backed off in the fog. But we were climbing again. Everyone screamed. I screamed. Christ, I thought, we sound as if we mean it. When it was over, the celebrants wandered off in the fog, wiping their eyes, holding on to each other. Mr. Shapeshade stood beside me as the dynamite men ran in to wrap their explosives around the girders and struts of the great ride. "Are you going to stay and watch?" said Mr. Shapeshade, gently. "I don't think I could stand it," I said. "I saw a film once where they shot an elephant right on screen. The way it fell down and over, collapsed, hurt me terribly. It was like watching someone bomb St. Peter's Dome. I wanted to kill the Hutters." "No thanks." A flagman, anyway, was waving us off. Shapeshade and I walked back through the fog. He took my elbow like a good middle European uncle advising his favorite nephew. "Tonight, no explosions, no destructions, only joy. Fun. Great old times. My theater. Maybe tonight is our last cinema night. Maybe tomorrow. Free. Gratis. Nice boy. Be there." He hugged me and plowed off through the fog like a great dark tugboat. On my way past A.L. Schrank's, I saw that his door was still wide open, but I didn't step in. I wanted to run, call collect on my gas station telephone, but I feared the 2,000 miles of silence would whisper back at me of deaths in sunlit streets, red meats hung in carniceria windows, and a loneliness so vast it was like an open wound. My hair grayed. It grew an inch. "Cal," I thought. "Dear dreadful barber, here I come." Cal's barbershop in Venice was situated right across the street from the city hall, and next door to a bail bond shop, where flies hung like dead trapeze artists from flypaper coils that had been left in the windows for 10 years, and where men and women from the jail across the way went in like shadows and came out like uninhabited clothes. And next door to that was a little ma and pa grocery. But they were gone, and their son sat on his pants in the window all day and sold maybe a can of soup and took horse race telephone bets. The barber shop, though it had a few flies in the window that had been dead no more than 10 days, at least got a washdown once a month from Cap, who ran the place with well-oiled shears and unoiled elbows and spearmint gossip in his all-pink mouth. He acted like he was running a bee farm, and afraid it would get out of hand as he wrestled the big silver bumbling insect around your ears until it suddenly froze, bit, and held onto your hair until Cal cursed and yanked back as if he were pulling teeth. Which was why, along with economics, I had my hair cut only twice a year by Cal. Twice yearly also, because of all the barbers in the world, Cal talked, sprayed, gummed, cudgeled, advised, and droned more than most, which boggles the mind. Name a subject, he knew it all, top, side, and bottom, and in the middle of explaining dumb Einstein's theory would stop, shut one eye, cock his head, and ask the great question with no safe answer. "Hey, did I ever tell you about me and old Scott Joplin? Why, old Scott and me, by God and by Jesus, listen.
That day in 1915 when he taught me how to play the maple leaf rag, let me tell you.
There was this picture of Scott Joplin on the wall, signed in ink a few centuries ago and fading like the canary lady's message. In that photo you could see a very young Cal, seated on a piano stool, and bent over him, Joplin, his big black hands covering those of the happy boy. There was that joyous kid forever on the wall, captured on film, hunched over to seize the piano keys, ready to leap on life, the world, the universe, eat it all. The look on that boy's face was such that it cracked my heart every time I saw it, so I didn't look at it often. It hurt enough to see Cal looking at it, gathering his spit to ask the age-old great question, and with no begs or requests, dash for the piano to maple leaf that rag. Cal. Cal looked like a cowpuncher who now rode barber chairs. Think of Texas cowhands, lean, weather-beaten, permanently dyed by sun, sleeping in their Stetsons, glued on for life, taking showers in the damn hats. That was Cal, circling the enemy, the customer, weapon in hand, eating the hair, chopping the sideburns, listening to the shears, admiring the Bumblebee Electric's harmonics, talking, talking, as I imagined him cowhand naked dancing around my chair, Stetson jam-packed nested above his ears, crave itching to leap to that piano and rake its smile. Sometimes I'd pretend I didn't see him throwing those mad stares, shuttling his love glances at the waiting black and white, white and black keys. But finally I'd heave a great masochistic sigh and cry, "Okay, Cal, get." Cal got. Galvanized, he shot across the room in a cowboy shamble, two of him, one in the mirror faster and brighter than the real one, yanking the piano lid up to show all that yellow dentistry just aching to have its music pulled. "Listen to this, son. You ever hear anything ever, ever in life, ever hear anything like this?" "No, Cal," I said, waiting in the chair with my head half ruined. "No," I said honestly, "I never did."
"My God,"
cried the old man coming out of the morgue a final time inside my head.
"Who gave him that awful haircut?"
I saw the guilty party standing in the window of his barber shop, gazing out at the fog, looking like one of those people in empty rooms or cafes or on street corners in paintings by Hopper. Cal. I had to force myself to pull open the front door and step in, gingerly, looking down. There were curlicues of brown, black, and gray hair all over the place. "Hey," I said with false joviality, "looks like you had a great day." "You know," said Cal, looking out the window, "that hair's been there 5-6 weeks. Ain't nobody in their right mind coming in that door save tramps, which isn't you, or fools, which isn't you, or bald men, which isn't you, asking directions to the madhouse, and poor people, which is you, so go sit down in the chair and prepare to be electrocuted. The electric clippers have been on the fritz for 2 months, and I ain't had the cash to get the goddamn things fixed. Sit." Obedient to my executioner, I bounded forward and sat and stared at the hair strews on the floor, symbols of a silent past that must have meant something but said nothing. Even looked at sidewise, I could figure no strange shapes or imminent forecasts. At last Cal turned and waded across that forlorn porcelain and forelock sea to let his hands pick up, all by themselves, the comb and scissors. He hesitated behind me, like the axeman sad to have to chop some young king's head. He asked how long I wanted it, or how ruined I wanted it, take your choice. But I was busy staring across the glaring white arctic emptiness of the shop at Cal's piano. For the first time in 15 years it was covered. Its gray-yellow oriental smile was invisible under a white mortuary bedsheet. "Cal!" My eyes were on the sheet. I had forgotten for a moment the old Venice ticket office man lying cold with a terrible haircut. "Cal," I said, "how come you're not maple-leafing the old rag?" Cal let his scissors snip-snip, and then snip-snip around my neck. "Cal," I said. "Something wrong?" I said. "When does the dying stop?" said Cal, a long way off. And now the bumblebee buzzed and stung my ears and made the old chill ripple down my spine. And then Cal got busy hacking away with his dull scissors as if he were harvesting a wild wheat crop, cursing under his breath. I smelled a faint whiskey odor, but kept my eyes straight ahead.
Cow,
I said. Shoot. No, shit is what I mean. He threw the scissors, comb, and dead silver bumblebee on the shelf and shambled across the ocean of old hair to yank the sheet off the piano, which grinned like a big mindless shape as he sat down and laid his two hands like limp paintbrushes on the keys, ready to paint God knows what. What came out was like broken teeth in a mashed jaw. Damn, hell, crud. I used to do it. Used to play the living guts out of that thing Scott taught me. Old Scott.
Scott.
His voice died. He had glanced up at the wall above the piano. He glanced away when he saw me looking, but it was too late. For the first time in 20 years, that picture of Scott Joplin was gone. I lurched forward in the chair, my mouth dropped wide, at which time Cal forced himself to hurl the sheet back over the smile and return, a mourner at his own wake, to stand behind my chair and pick up the torture instruments again. Scott Joplin, 97. Cal the Barber, 0, he said, describing a lost game. He ran his trembling fingers over my head. Jesus, look what I've done to you. My God, that's a lousy cut, and I'm not even halfway in. I ought to pay you for all the years you let me make you run around looking like an Airedale with mange. On top of which, let me tell you what I did to a customer 3 days ago. It's terrible. Maybe I made the poor son of a bitch look so bad someone killed him to put him out of his misery. I lurched forward again, but Cal put me gently back. I should give Novocaine, but I don't. About this old guy. Listen.
I'm listening, Cal,
I said, for that was why I was here.
Sat right where you were sitting now,
said Cal.
Sat right there, just like you're sitting. Looked in the mirror and said, shoot the works.
That's what he said.
Cal, shoot the works. Biggest night of my life, he said. Myron's Ballroom, downtown L.A. Haven't been there in years. Called, said I'd won the grand prize, he said.
For what, I said?
Most important old resident of Venice, they said.
Why is that a cause for celebration?
Shut up and primp up, they said.
So here I am, Cal. Short all around, but don't billiard ball me. And some of that tiger tonic, shake it on me. I cut until hell wouldn't have it. Old man must have saved up 2 years of high snow mountain hair, drenched him with tonic until the fleas fled, sent him out happy, leaving his last $2 behind, I wouldn't wonder.
Sitting right where you are.
And now he's dead, Cal added.
Dead!
I almost shouted. Somebody found him in a lion cage, submerged under the canal waters.
Dead.
Somebody, I said. But didn't add me. I figure the old man never had any champagne before, or it was a long time back, got loaded, fell in.
Cal, he said, the works.
It just goes to show you, right? Could be me or you in that canal just as likely, and now, hot damn and old breakfasts, he's alone forever. Don't it make you think? Hey now, son, you don't look too well. I talk too much, right?
Did he say who was going to pick him up, and how, and when, and why? I said.
Nothing fancy, far as I could tell. Someone coming on the big Venice short line train, pick him up, take him right down to Myron's ballroom door. You ever get on the train Saturday nights around 1? Old ladies and old gents piling out of Myron's in their mothball furs and green tuxedos, smelling of Ben-Hur perfume and nickel panatellas. Glad they didn't break a leg in the dance floor. Bald head sweating, mascara running, and the fox furs starting to spoil. I went once, and looked around, and got out. I figured the streetcar might stop at Roselawn Cemetery on the way to the sea, and half those folks get out. No thanks. I talk too much, don't I? Just tell me if I do. Anyways, he went on at last, he's dead and gone. And the awful thing is, he'll be lying in the grave the next 1,000 years, remembering who in hell gave him his last awful haircut. And the answer is me. So it's been one of them weeks. People with bad haircuts disappear, wind up drowned. And at long last, I know damn well my hands are no good for nothing. And
you don't know who it was picked the old man up and took him to that dance?
Who knows? Who cares? Old man said whoever it was told him to meet him down front of the Venice Cinema at 7. See part of a show. Have a dinner at Modesti's, the last cafe on the pier still open, boy howdy. And head downtown to the ballroom.
Or a fast waltz with a 99-year-old Rose Queen. What a night, hey?
And home to bed. Forever. But why would you want to know all this, son? You...
The telephone rang. Cal looked at it, his face draining of color. The telephone rang 3 times.
"Aren't you going to answer it, Cal?" I said.
Cal looked at it the same way I looked at my gas station office phone and 2,000 miles of silence and heavy breathing along the way. He shook his head.
"Why would I answer a phone when there's nothing but bad news on it?" he said.
"Some days you feel that way," I said. I pulled the apron from around my neck, slowly, and got up. Automatically, Cal's hand went palm out for my cash. When he saw his hand there, he cursed and dropped his hand, turned and banged the cash register. Up jumped no sale. I looked at myself in the mirror and almost barked like a seal at what I saw. "It's a great haircut, Cal," I said.
"Get out of here."
On the way out, I put my hand up to touch where the picture of Scott Joplin used to hang, playing great stuff with fingers like 2 bunches of big black bananas. If Cal saw this, he didn't say. I slipped on some old hair going out. I walked until I found Sunshine and Crumley's buried in deep grass bungalow. I stood outside. Crumley must have felt me there. He yanked the door open and said, "You doing that again?" "I never did. I'm no good at being out scaring people at 3 o'clock in the morning," I said. He looked down at his left hand and shoved it at me. There was a small clot of oily green seaweed on his palm, his clench marks in it. I held out my hand like someone trumping an ace and opened my fingers. My identical clump of seaweed, drier and brittle, lay in my palm. Crumley's eyes moved from both our hands up to my eyes, my brow, my cheeks, my chin. He exhaled.
"Apricot pie, Halloween pumpkins, backyard tomatoes, late summer peaches, Santa Claus's California son. You look like all of them. With a face like that, how can I yell guilty?"
He dropped his hands and stood aside.
"You do like beer, don't you?"
"Not much," I said.
"Would you rather I fix you a chocolate malt?"
"Could you?"
"No, goddammit, you'll drink beer and like it. Get it in here."
He wandered off, shaking his head. And I came in and shut the door, feeling like a high school student come back to visit his 10th grade teacher. Crumley was standing in his parlor window, blinking out at the dry dirt path I had wandered up a moment ago. 3 o'clock, by God," he muttered. 3, right out there. I heard someone weeping. How you figure that? Crying? Gave me the goosebumps. Sounded like a banshee woman. Hell. Let me look at your face again. I showed him my face. "Jesus," he said, "do you always blush that easily?" "I can't help it." "Christ, you could massacre half a Hindu village and still look like Peter Rabbit. What are you stuffed with?" "Chocolate bars. And I keep 6 kinds of ice cream in my icebox when I can afford it. I bet you buy it instead of bread." I wanted to say no, but he would have caught the lie. "Take a load off your feet, and what kind of beer do you hate most? I got Budweiser, which is awful, Budweiser, which is dreadful, and Bud, which is the worst. Take your pick. No, don't allow me." He ambled off to the kitchen and came back with 2 cans. "There's still a little sun. Let's get out of here." He led the way into his backyard. I couldn't believe Crumley's garden. "Why not?" He steered me out the back door of his bungalow into a green and luscious illumination of thousands of plants. Ivies, papyrus, birds of paradise, succulents, cacti. Crumley beamed. "Got 6 dozen different species of epiphyllum over there. That's Iowa corn against the fence. That's a plum tree. That's apricot. That's orange. Want to know why?" "Everyone in the world needs 2, 3 jobs, I said without hesitation. "One job isn't enough, just as one life isn't enough. I want to have 12 of both." "Bullseye. Doctors should dig ditches. Ditch diggers ought to run kindergartens 1 day a week. Philosophers should wash dishes in a greasy spoon 2 nights out of 10. Mathematicians should blow whistles at high school gyms. Poets should drive trucks for a change of menu, and police detectives should own and operate the Garden of Eden," I said quietly. "Jesus." Crumley laughed and shook his head and looked at the green seaweed he ground in his palm. "You're a pain in the ass know-it-all. You think you got me figured? Surprise." He bent and twisted a garden valve. "Hark, as they used to say. Hist." A soft rain sprang up in brilliant blooms that touched all around Eden with whispers that said, "Soft, quiet, serenity.
stay, live forever. I felt all my bones diminish in my flesh. Something like a dark skin fell from my back. Crumley tilted his head to one side to study my face.
Well?
I shrugged. You see so much rot every week, you need this.
Trouble is, the guys over at the station won't try anything like this.
Sad, huh? To just be a cop and nothing else forever? Christ, I'd kill myself.
You know what? I wish I could bring all the rot I see every week here and use it for fertilizer. Boy, what roses I'd grow.
Or Venus flytraps, I said. He mused on that and nodded.
That earns you a beer.
He led the way into his kitchen, and I stood looking out at the rainforest, taking deep breaths of the cool air, but not able to smell it because of my cold. I've passed your place for years, I said, and wondered who could possibly live back in such a great homemade forest. Now that I've met you, I know it had to be you. Crumley had to stop himself from falling on the floor and writhing with joy at the compliment. He controlled himself and opened two really terrible beers, one of which I managed to sip.
"Can't you make a better face than that?" he asked. "You really like malts better?"
"Yeah." I took a bigger sip, and it gave me courage to ask, "One thing. What am I doing here? You asked me over because of that stuff you found out front of your house, that seaweed? Now here I am surveying your jungle and drinking your bad beer. No longer a suspect?"
"Oh, for Christ's sake!"
Crumley swigged his own drink and blinked at me. "If I thought you were any kind of mad lion tamer cage filler-upper, you'd have been in the toilet 2 days ago. You think I don't know all about you?"
"There's not much to know," I said sheepishly. "Like hell there isn't. Listen."
Crumley took another swig, shut his eyes, and read the details off the back of his eyelids. "One block from your apartment's a liquor store, and an ice cream parlor, and next to that a Chinese grocery. They all think you're mad. The nut, they call you. The fool on occasion. You talk loud and lots. They hear. Every time you sell a story to Weird Tales or Astonishing Stories, it's all over the pier because you open your window and yell.
Christ.
But the bottom line is, kid, they like you. You got no future, sure, they all agree, because who in hell is really going to go and land on the moon? When? Between now and the year 2000, will anyone give a damn about Mars? Only you, Flash Gordon. Only crazy nut you, Buck Rogers." I was blushing furiously, head down, half angry and somewhat embarrassed, but somehow pleased at all this attention. I had been called Flash and Buck often, but somehow when Crumley did it, it went right by without wounding. Crumley opened his eyes, saw my blush, and said,
"Now cut that out!"
"Why would you have known all this about me a long time before the old man was..." I stopped and changed it. "Before he died.
I'm curious about everything."
"Most people aren't. I discovered that when I was 14. Everybody else gave up toys that year. I told my folks, no toys, no Christmas. So they kept on giving me toys every year. The other boys got shirts and ties. I took astronomy. Out of 4,000 students in my high school, there were only 15 other boys and 14 girls who looked at the sky with me. The rest were out running around the track and watching their feet. So it follows that..." I turned instinctively, for something had stirred in me. I found myself wandering across the kitchen. "I got a hunch," I said. "Could I..."
"What?" said Crumley.
"You got a workroom here?"
"Sure. Why?"
Crumley frowned with faint alarm. That only made me push a bit harder. "Mind if I see?"
"Well..."
I moved in the direction toward which Crumley's eyes had darted. The room was right off the kitchen. It had once been a bedroom, but now it was empty except for a desk, a chair, and a typewriter on the desk.
"I knew it," I said.
I went to stand behind the chair and look at the machine, which was not an old beat-up Underwood Standard, but a fairly new Corona with a fresh ribbon in it and a stack of yellow sheets waiting to one side.
"That explains why you look at me the way you do," I said.
"Lord, yes. Always tilting your head this way and that, scowling, narrowing your eyes. Trying to x-ray that big head of yours, see if there's a brain in there, and how it does what it does," said Crumley, tilting his head now to the left, now to the right. "Nobody knows how the brain works, not writers, no one.
All I do is throw up every morning, clean up at noon.
Bullshit, said Crumley gently.
Truth. I looked at the desk, which had three drawers on either side of the cubby. I put my hand out and down toward the bottom drawer on the left.
Crumley shook his head.
I shifted and reached over to touch the bottom drawer on the right.
Crumley nodded.
I pulled the drawer open slowly.
Crumley exhaled.
There was a manuscript there in an open-top box. It looked to be about 150 to 200 pages, beginning on page one with no title page.
How long's this been down here in the bottom drawer? I asked.
Pardon. It's all right, said Crumley.
5 years.
You're going to finish it now, I said.
Like hell I am. Why?
Because I told you so, and I know.
Shut the drawer, said Crumley.
Not just yet. I pulled out the chair, sat, and rolled a sheet of yellow paper into the machine. I typed 5 words on one line and then shifted down and wrote 3 more words. Crumley squinted over my shoulder and read them aloud, quietly.
Death is a lonely business.
He took a breath and finished it. By Elmo Crumley.
He had to repeat it.
By Elmo Crumley, by God.
There.
I placed my new title page down on top of his waiting manuscript, then slid the drawer shut.
That's a gift.
I'll find another title for my book. Now you'll have to finish it. I rolled another sheet of paper into the machine and asked, what was the number of the last page on the bottom of your manuscript?
162, said Crumley.
I typed 163 and left the paper in the machine.
There, I said. It's waiting. Tomorrow morning you get out of bed, walk to the machine, no phone calls, no newspaper reading, don't even go to the bathroom. Sit down, type, and Elmo Crumley is immortal.
B.S., said Crumley, but ever so quietly.
God promises.
But you got to work. I got up and Crumley and I stood looking at his corona as if it were the only child he would ever have.
You giving me orders, kid? Said Crumley.
No. Your brain is, if you just listen.
Crumley backed off, walked into the kitchen, got some more beer. I waited by his desk until I heard the back screen door bang.
I found Crumley in his garden, letting the whirl around water tosser cover his face with cooling raindrops, for the day was warm now, and the sun out full here on the rim of fog country.
What is it? Said Crumley. 40 stories you sold so far?
At $30 apiece, yeah. The rich author.
You are rich. I stood down at the magazine rack at Abe's Liquor yesterday and read that one you wrote about the man who finds he has a skeleton inside him and it scares hell out of him.
Christ, it was a beaut. Where in hell do you get ideas like that?
I got a skeleton inside me, I said.
Most people never notice.
Crumley handed me a beer and watched me make yet another face.
The old man.
William Smith.
Yeah, William Smith. The autopsy report came in this morning. There was no water in his lungs.
That means he didn't drown.
That means he was killed up on the canal bank and shoved down into the cage after he was dead. That proves,
don't jump ahead of the train, you'll get run down. And don't say I told you so, or I'll take that beer back.
I offered him the beer gladly. He nudged my hand aside.
What have you done about the haircut? I said.
What haircut?
Mr. Smith had a really lousy haircut the afternoon before he died. His friend moaned about it at the morgue, remember? I knew only one really lousy barber could have done it.
I told Crumley about Cal, the prizes promised William Smith, Myron's ballroom, Modesty's, the big red train.
Crumley listened patiently and said,
Flimsy.
It's all we got, I said.
You want me to check the Venice Cinema to see if they saw him out front the night he disappeared?
No. Said Crumley.
You want me to check Modesty's?
The train. Myron's ballroom.
No, said Crumley.
What do you want me to do then?
Stay out of it.
Why?
Because, said Crumley, and stopped.
He glanced at the back door of his house.
Anything happens to you, my goddamn novel never gets finished. Somebody's got to read the damn thing, and I don't know anybody else.
You forget, I said. Whoever stood outside your house last night stands outside mine already. I can't let him do that, can I? I can't go on being spooked by that guy who gave me the title I just typed on your machine, can I?
Crumley looked at my face, and I could see his thinking was apricot pie, banana cake, and strawberry ice cream.
"Just be careful," he said at last. "The old man may have slipped and knocked his head and was dead when he hit the water, which is why there was no water in his lungs."
And then he swam over and put himself in the cage. "Sure." Crumley squinted at me, trying to guess my weight. Silently, he went away into the jungle and was gone about a minute. I waited. Then, far away, I heard an elephant trombone the wind. I turned slowly into a drench of garden rain, listening. A lion, closer, opened his vast beehive valves and exhaled a killer swarm. A herd of antelopes and gazelles dusted by like a summer wind of sound, touching the dry earth, moving my heart to their run. Crumley was suddenly on the path, smiling wildly like a boy half proud, half ashamed of a madness unknown to all the world until now, this hour. He snorted and gestured two fresh beers up at six lilyhorn sound systems, suspended like great dark flowers in the trees. From these, the antelopes, gazelles, and zebras circled our lives and protected us from the nameless beasts out beyond the bungalow fences. The elephant blew his nose once more and knocked my soul flat.
"African recordings," said Crumley, unnecessarily.
"Swell," I said. "Hey, what's that?" 10,000 African flamingos, airlifted from a bright freshwater lagoon back 5,000 days ago when I was a high school kid, and Martin and Osa Johnson were flying in from the wildebeest African trails to walk among us plain folks in California and tell great tales. And then I remembered. The day I was supposed to run full speed to hear Martin Johnson speak, he had been killed in a plane crash just outside L.A. But right now, in Elmo Crumley's jungle compound Eden Retreat, there were Martin Johnson's birds. My heart went with them. I looked at the sky and said, "What are you going to do, Crumley?"
"Nothing," he said. "The old canary lady is going to live forever. You can bet on it."
"I'm broke," I said. When the drowned people showed up later that day, it really spoiled the picnics all up and down the beach. People were indignant, packed their hampers, went home. Dogs that ran eagerly down to look at the strangers lying on the shore were called back by angry women or irritable men. Children were herded away and sent off with a reprimand, not to associate with such peculiar strangers ever again. Drowning, after all, was a forbidden subject. Like sex, it was never discussed. It followed, then, that when a drowned person dared touch shore, he or she was persona non grata. Children might dash down to hold dark ceremonies in their minds, but the ladies who remained after the families had cringed off and gone away raised their parasols and turned their backs, as if someone with unruly breath had called from the surf. Nothing in Emily Post could help the situation. Very simply, the lost surfers had come without invite, permission, or warning, and, like unwanted relatives, had to be hustled off to mysterious ice houses inland at a double dog trot. But no sooner was one surf stranger gone than you heard the sandpiping children's voices crying, "Look, Mommy! Oh, look! Get away! Get!" And you heard the rush of feet running away from the still warm landmines on the shore. Walking back from Crumley's, I heard about the unwelcome visitors, the drowned ones. I had hated to leave the sun which seemed to shine forever in Crumley's orchard. Reaching the sea was like touching another country. The fog came as if glad for all the bad shoreline news. The drownings had had nothing to do with police, night traumas, or dark surprises in canals that sucked their teeth all night. It was simply riptides. The shore was empty now, but I had an even emptier feeling when I lifted my gaze to the old Venice Pier. "Bad rice," I heard someone whisper. "Me." An old Chinese imprecation, shouted at the edges of crops to guarantee a good harvest against the devastation of the envious gods. Bad rice. For someone had at last stepped on the big snake. Someone had stomped it down. The roller coaster was gone forever from the far end of the pier. What was left of it now lay in the late day like a great strewn jackstraws game. But only a big steam shovel was playing that game now, snorting, bending down to snap up the bones and find them good.
When does the dying stop?
I had heard Cal say a few hours back. With the empty pier end ahead, its skeleton being flensed, and a tidal wave of fog storming toward shore, I felt a fusillade of cold darts in my back. I was being followed. I spun. But it wasn't me being pursued by nothing. Across the street, I saw A.L. Schrank. He ran along, hands deep in overcoat pockets, head sunk in his dark collar, glancing back like a rat before hounds. God, I thought, now I know who he reminds me of. Poe. The famous photographs, the somber portraits of Edgar Allan with his vast milk-glass lamp-glow brow and brooding night-fire eyes, and the doomed and lost mouth buried under the dark mustache, his tie askew on his untidy collar, over his always convulsing and swallowing throat. Edgar Allan Poe. Poe ran. Schrank ran, glancing back at a swift fog with no shape. Christ, I thought, it's after all of us. By the time I reached the Venice Cinema, the fog, impatient, had already gone in. Mr. Shapeshade's old Venice Cinema was special because it was the last of a series of night riverboats afloat on the edge of the tide anywhere in the world. The front part of the cinema was on the concrete walk that leads from Venice down toward Ocean Park and Santa Monica. The back half of it stuck out on the pier so that its rear end was over the water. I stood in front of the movie house at this late hour of the day, glanced up at the marquee, and gasped. There were no films listed. Only one huge 2-foot-high word. Goodbye. It was like being stabbed in the stomach. I stepped forward to the ticket booth. Shapeshade was there smiling at me with manic goodwill as he waved. Goodbye? I said mournfully. Sure, Shapeshade laughed. Ta-ta, toodaloo, farewell. And it's free. Go in. Any friend of Douglas Fairbanks, Thomas Meehan, Milton Sills, and Charles Ray is a friend of mine. I melted at the names from my childhood, people I had seen flickering on ancient screens when I was 2, 3, 4 on my mother's knee in a cool movie house in northern Illinois, before the bad rice came and we steamed west in an old beat-up Kissel ahead of the Okies, my dad looking for a 12-buck-a-week job. I can't go in, Mr. Shapeshade. Look at the boy who won't! Shapeshade threw his hands to the heavens and rolled his eyeballs like Stromboli, irritated by Pinocchio and itching to cut his strings. Why not? When I come out of movies in daylight, I get depressed. Nothing's right. So where's the sun? Cried Shapeshade. By the time you exit, it's night. Anyway, I wanted to ask you about 3 nights ago, I said. Did you by any chance see that old ticket office man, Bill, Willie, William Smith, waiting out front here that night? I yelled at him, yes. What happened to your head, I said. Did a grizzly bear claw your wig off, I said. His hair was a laugh riot. So who took a lawnmower to him, Demon Cal? Yeah. Did you see someone meet William Smith and take him away? I got busy. All of a sudden, 6 people came for tickets. 6! When I looked around, Mr. Smith, Willie, was gone. Why? My shoulders sank. My frustration must have shown in my face. Shapeshade quickened with sympathy and enunciated his sen-sen breath through the ticket booth's glass speak hole. Guess who's inside on the big 1922 moth-hole-sieved silver screen? Fairbanks, the Black Pirate, Gish, Broken Blossoms, Lon Chaney, Phantom of the Opera. Who was greater? Lord, Mr. Shapeshade, those are all silent. So? Where were you in 1928 you didn't notice? The more talky, the less movie. Statues they played. Mouths moved and your feet went to sleep. So these last nights, silence. Quiet, yes? Silence and gestures 40 feet across, and scowls and leers 20 feet high. Quiet phantoms, mums the word pirates, gargoyles and hunchbacks who talked in winds and rains and let the organ speak for them, eh? Plenty of seats. Go! He thumped his brass ticket key. The machine stuck a nice fresh orange ticket out at me. Yes. I took the ticket and looked into the face of this old man who hadn't been out in sun for 40 years, who loved films madly, and would rather read Silver Screen than the Encyclopedia Britannica. His eyes were gently mad with his love of old faces on yesterday's posters. "Is Shapeshade your real name?" I said at last.
"It means a house like this where shades are shaped, and all shapes are shadows. You got a better name?"
"No, sir, Mr. Shapeshade." And I hadn't.
"What?" I started to ask, but Shapeshade guessed with relish. "What happens to me tomorrow when they knock my movie house down? Say not to worry. I got protection. So have my films, all 300 of them, up in the booth now. But soon, down the beach 1 mile south, the basement there where I go run films and laugh." "Constance Radigan," I cried. "I've often seen that funny light flickering in her basement window, or up in her front parlor late nights. Was that you?"
"Who else?" beamed Shapeshade. "For years now, when I finish here, I just foxtrot along the shore with 20 pounds of film under each arm. Sleeps all day, Constance does. Watches films and eats popcorn with me all night. That's Radigan. And we sit and hold hands like two crazy kids, and rob the film vaults, and cry sometimes so much we can't see to rewind the spools." I looked out at the beach beyond the cinema front, and could not help but see Mr. Shapeshade jogging the surf in the dark, toting popcorn and Mary Pickford, Holloway Suckers and Tom Mix, on his way to that ancient queen, to be her subservient lover of multifold darks and lights that sprocketed the dream screen with just as many sunrises as sunsets. And then Shapeshade watching just before dawn, as Constance Radigan, so the rumors said, ran naked to leap into the cold salt waves and rise with health food seaweeds in her straight white teeth and regally braiding her hair, while Shapeshade limped home in the rising sun, drunk on remembrance, mumming and humming the drones of the mighty Wurlitzer in his marrow, soul, heart, and happy mouth.
"Listen." He leaned forward like Ernest Thesiger in the dim halls of the old dark house, or as Dr. Praetorius looming in Bride of Frankenstein. "Inside. Go up behind the screen. Have you ever? No. Climb up on stage in the night behind the screen. What an experience! Like being in Caligari's lopsided chambers. You will thank me forever." I shook his hand and stared. "My gosh," I cried, "that hand of yours, isn't that the paw that slid out of the dark behind the library bookshelves in The Cat and the Canary to grab and vanish the lawyer before he could read the will?" Shapeshade stared down at his hand cradled in mine and beamed. "Aren't you a nice boy?" he said. "I try, Mr. Shapeshade," I said. "I try."
Inside, I blundered down the aisle until I felt my way to the brass rail and half-flopped up the proscenium steps onto an always midnight stage to duck behind the screen and look at the great ghosts. And ghosts they were, the tall, pale, and black-eyed shadow phantoms of time, twisted like white taffy from the slanted angle at which I saw them, gesturing and mouthing in the silence, waiting for the organ music which had not yet begun. And there in swift clip after chop after clip was Fairbanks with an askew face, and Gish wax melting down the screen, and Fatty Arbuckle thinned from this side view and knocking his starved head against the top of the frame and slithering off into the dark, while I stood feeling the tide move under the floor, the pier, the theater, which foundered in swarming waters, now tilting and creaking and shivering with the smell of salt coming up through the boards, and more pictures white as cream, dark as ink, blinking across the screen as the theater lifted like a bellows and sank down exhaling like a bellows, and me sunk with it. Just then the organ exploded. It was like that moment a few hours ago when the great unseen steamliner had plunged to strike the pier. The theater careened, heaved up, and fell as if on a rollercoastal tide.
The organ shouted and brayed and ricocheted a Bach prelude so that dust flew off the ancient chandeliers, the curtains stirred restlessly like funeral gowns, and myself behind the screen reaching out to hold on to something, but terrified that something might touch back. Above me the pale images ached and gibbered their mouths, and the phantom strode down the stairs at the Paris Opera in his white skull mask and plumed hat, even as Shapeshade a moment before must have strode down the dark aisle to rattle and chime the brass rings holding the short curtain around the organ, and seat himself like destiny and doom to spider the keys and shut his eyes and gape his mouth to let Bach out. Afraid to look behind, I stared out past the 30-foot phantoms at an audience unseen, riveted in place, shuddering with music, drawn by terrible images, lifted and then jolted down by the night tide under the theater deck. Among all those pale faces, fixing their eyes upon the flickering past, was he there? The mourner on the train, the pacer along the canal rim, the weaver of 3 in the morning rains, was that his face over here, or that one over there? Colorless moons trembling in the dark, a cluster of souls in front, another back halfway, 50, 60 people, dreadful suspects on yet another fog excursion, rushing to collide with nightmare and sink with no sound, only the great suck of the sea going back for reinforcements. Among all these night travelers, which was he, I wondered, and what could I shout to panic him up the aisles with me in wild pursuit? A giant skull smiled from the screen. The lovers fled to the opera roof, the phantom pursued to unfurl his cape and overhear their fearful love talk and grin. The organ shrieked, the theater bucked and heaved with heavy waters celebrating sea burials should the planks gape and drop us down through. My eyes raced from dimly upturned face to face, and up, up, to the little window of the projectionist's booth, where a section of brow and a maniac eye peered down at the delicious dooms painted on the screen in geysers of light and dark. Poe's raven eye, or rather shrank. Tarot card reader, psychologist, phrenologist, numerologist, and film projectionist. Someone had to run the film while Shapeshade clawed the organ in paroxysms of delight. Most nights the old man ran from ticket booth to projection room to organ, bouncing off each like a manic boy disguised as rambling man. But now? Who else for a late-night menu of hunchbacks, striding skeletons, and hairy paws snatching moon pearls from a sleeping woman's neck? Shrank. The organ music peaked. The phantom vanished. A new clip from Jekyll and Hyde, 1920, jittered across the screen. I leaped down off the stage and ran up the aisle, among all the fiends and murderers. The Poe eye in the projectionist's window was gone. By the time I reached the projection booth, it was empty. The film unspooled itself in the Firefly machine. Jekyll, on his way to becoming Hyde, slid down the light beams to strike a hairball on the screen. The music stopped. Downstairs on the way out, I found an exhausted but happy Shapeshade back in the ticket booth, selling seats to the fog. I thrust my hands in to grab his and squeeze. No bad rice for you, huh? What? Cried Shapeshade, complimented but not knowing why. You'll live forever, I said. What do you know that God doesn't? Asked Shapeshade. Come back later, 1 in the morning. Vight in Caligari. 2, Cheney in Laugh Clown Laugh. 3, The Gorilla. 4, The Bat. Who could ask for more? Not me, Mr. Shapeshade. I moved off into the mist. You're not depressed, he yelled after. I don't think so. If you got to think about it, you're not. Full night had arrived. I saw that Modesti's cafe had closed early. Or forever, I didn't know which. I couldn't ask questions there about William Smith and celebratory haircuts and dinners. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.